WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Virginia's new lab schools, including the one at JMU, could already be facing less funding. The governor signs dozens of bills, including legislation protecting digital menstrual health data. But among his vetoes, a bill that would have protected abortion providers from extradition. And award-winning Harrisonburg author Sophia Samatar talks about why her latest work is one of science fiction. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, April 8th. Governor Glenn Youngkin's lab school program links colleges, including JMU, with local school systems. But funding for the experiment in education could be reduced in the next budget, Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
James Madison University's lab school program is one of six programs approved so far. Brian Zugelder is part of JMU's School of Education. He said the program was deeply connected with local business leaders, professors, Blue Ridge Community College, and Rockingham County Public Schools to create a unique educational experience for students.
So rather than hearing about science, they'll actually be doing science, while also learning what it means to be a good reader, a good writer, a good listener, a good speaker.
It's all part of Governor Glenn Youngkin's effort to expand education options in the state, and it was started with about $100 million in the state's 2022 budget. In a post on X, after the recent approval of more lab school programs, Youngkin praised them for serving thousands of students and, quote, harnessing innovation to meet the specific needs of the communities and families. But Democrats, who now control the legislature, want to increase public education funding for established K-12 schools. Roanoke Delegate Sam Rasool is the chair of the House Education Committee.
We need to do things like give teacher raises. Unfortunately, there just wasn't enough in his introduced budget to help teachers and other public servants keep up with growing cost of living.
The big budget showdown is set to start Monday, when Youngkin is expected to release his proposed amendments to the legislature's spending plan. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Full disclosure, JMU's Board of Visitors holds WMRA's operating license, and JMU underwrites programming on the station. Governor Glenn Youngkin signed 88 bills on Friday and vetoed 11 others, the Associated Press reports. Among those he vetoed included legislation that aimed to help protect women and medical practitioners from potential extraditions related to abortion services that are legal in Virginia. Youngkin said that the measures would undermine the nation's long-standing legal framework for extraditions. But the governor also signed separate legislation supported by abortion rights groups that prohibits the issuance of search warrants, subpoenas, or court orders for electronic or digital menstrual health data. Youngkin also signed legislation last week that would make law enforcement decertification proceedings less transparent. Virginia's Department of Criminal Justice Services oversees the officer decertification process. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that the new law allows for those proceedings to be closed. It also will make related documents exempt from Freedom of Information Act requests. The law will take effect on July 1st. The deadline for the governor to sign, amend, or veto all bills from this session is tonight at midnight. Virginia's participation in a carbon market is at the center of budget debates. Jad Khalil with VPM News reports.
Governor Glenn Youngkin has through Monday to act on the budget Democrats sent him. He can amend the bill or veto specific parts. One of those parts he had signaled he'd veto is participation in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, aka REGI. But Democrats embedded the requirement to rejoin REGI inside a bigger part of the budget. Former Attorney General Jerry Kilgore says legal precedent means Youngkin would have to veto all or nothing of a budget item. He can't pick or choose, although he adds a caveat.
But of course, that's a gray area, and I think the governor may want to figure that out, have the courts figure that out.
Noah Sullivan used to be former Governor Terry McAuliffe's counsel. He says there's a separation of power issue at play, too.
Because if the governor does not assert some authority to push back, then what would stop the legislature from just putting everything it wants and he doesn't like into the budget?
The governor didn't respond to a request for comment by airtime.
Jad Khalil reporting. The agency that oversees wildlife in Virginia reports a growing number of sick birds in the eastern part of the Commonwealth. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman reports.
It's spring and birds are migrating, passing through Virginia and perhaps spreading disease.
Starting in about 2020, there was a recognition that in wild bird populations, there was a new strain, this H5N1 avian influenza strain.
Dr. Patrick Jackson is an expert on infectious disease at UVA. He says this sickness has yet to infect domestic animals here, but chicken farmers in the Shenandoah Valley and on the Eastern Shore are on high alert.
Making sure that it doesn't get into the food supply is a major issue. One of the things that we saw last year and may see again this year is that poultry producers are being quite cautious about not allowing this influenza into their flocks.
And public health officials are also on notice after a farmer in Texas contracted bird flu. Jackson says viruses can mutate and jump from other species to people, but he's not especially worried.
The simple fact that one individual human was infected with this virus doesn't necessarily mean that it's well adapted to spread from human to human and cause a big problem right now.
He warns people who work with birds to wear masks, eye protection, and rubber gloves. And if you find dead birds in your yard or neighborhood, the state also advises caution and a call to the Department of Wildlife Resources in Richmond. I'm Sandy Hausman.
And finally today, award-winning Harrisonburg author Sophia Samatar often sets her stories in other worlds. Her latest book is a science fiction novella that deals with issues concerning access and diversity in higher education, but through the veil of a space adventure. Sophia Samatar is our guest for Books and Brews Tuesday night in Harrisonburg. WMRA's Chris Boros asked Sophia, why science fiction?
Part of what science fiction can do is to place us somewhere else so that we can kind of get outside the situation we're in, and then we can have a little bit more freedom in the way that we look at it and turn ideas around. So what I have in the book is a university that's in space, and it is attached to a prison. And the main character is a boy. He's never known anything but this prison, and he is selected for a scholarship, and he is brought upstairs to attend a university. So already there, you can see in a science fiction setting a very common problem that we struggle with in higher education, which is that there tends to be a focus on cherry-picking people, like one person at a time, rather than trying to solve the underlying issues, like why does this spaceship have to be half university and half prison.
You often set your stories in fantastical settings as opposed to quote-unquote the real world. Is there a reason that you gravitate toward other worlds?
There is, and I wish I knew what it was.
I love it.
I have thought about it a lot. I have studied fantasy, and really all of this was just trying to understand myself. The question, why do you write things that are fantastical, could easily be spun around, because from what we know about human beings and their stories, fantasy is much, much older than realism. You know, it's the human genre. It's what the humans do. There is kind of a feeling of being in the midst of a science fictional universe that I think many people have from time to time.
I wonder if we can then go back to some of these science fiction stories and maybe learn from the mistakes these characters made.
I think that's part of what the genre allows, is that you go to this other world and play around in it and try out different things. It can be a kind of springboard for ideas, because you can't implement all of your ideas in the real world. Science fiction is a space where you can try things out, very similar to, you know, a thought experiment in philosophy, where people say, well, what if this?
When you were growing up, do you remember a book that you discovered that made you fall in love with science fiction or fantasy?
There were so many. So I started very much with C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, sure, and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Those were the big ones. In terms of science fiction, Ursula Le Guin was a really important writer for me.
How early did the writing process start for you? I mean, were you writing stories as a child?
I was. The writing process started when I learned how to form letters.
Wow.
And I wrote my first book when I was about 5 or 6. I still have it.
What?
It's called Simpy and the Rat. It's about a little girl named Simpy who has a pet rat, and her mother wants her to get rid of it, and drama ensues.
And you were 5?
Yeah, 5 or 6. six. Yeah.
When you say your first book, I mean, how long is this book?
It's 500 pages. No, I'm just kidding.
I was going to say.
No, it's nothing like that. No, it's a little, I mean, it's on, like, my mother was working as a secretary, and she would bring home, like, the paper that they were going to throw out, she would bring home for my brother and me to write and draw on. So, you know, it's a few sheets of paper, and I kind of taped it together, and wrote this little story in between the other stuff that was written, that was typed on these pages.
Wow, and you taped it together to make it look like a book.
Oh, yeah. I always wanted to make books that looked like real books.
That is so cool that at that young of an age, you knew what you wanted to do, and here you are doing it.
Yeah, I feel lucky that way. I mean, you know, because there are a lot of people who spend a lot of time unsure what they want to do.
Why write? What do you get out of the process when you're sitting down and writing? How does it, like, help you in your life?
It helps me think. Writing is an incredible practice for working on very complex problems. You know, when you get things down on paper, you're not just spinning in your head. Writing is a way of putting something down on paper. Now you have something to work with. You can then sort of work with your thought as you're cutting, as you're pasting, as you're putting things in a different order. It really allows you to fine-tune your thinking. And that, you know, for somebody who likes to think, this is great.
Sophia Samatar's new book is The Practice, The Horizon, and The Chain. She's our speaker for Books and Brews tomorrow night at 7 in Harrisonburg at Pale Fire Brewing. And we have details at WMRA.org. Sophia, it has been a delight to talk to you again. Thank you so much. Looking forward to Books and Brews.
Thank you.
Visit WMRA.org to hear a longer version of this interview. And for more on Books and Brews, Tuesday evening, which will also feature Greg Wren, author of Mothership. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. And I hope you enjoy your Monday.